if there was an alien watching your life from outer space based on your life, not based on what you say you value, would they know that that is actually your passion? Relationships are too important and too challenging to take for granted. Welcome to The Attached Life. I want to wrap up the Overcoming Loneliness series on this podcast in a unique way by looking at a body of research that is really amazing, just truly, truly incredible work that sheds so much light and offers so much insight into human development and how we become the way that we are and how children in general develop. And as always, it gives us a lens as parents, for those of us who are, into how we're raising our kids. And more poignantly, for our purposes, it gives us insight into ourselves and where we have underdeveloped muscles, underdeveloped pieces of our personalities and who we are and the way we live, and where we can nurture and re-educate and strengthen ourselves. The research I'm referring to is research that I actually came across when I had the honor of having Dr. David Pelkovitz write a foreword for my book, Attached. And in his foreword, he briefly cites the research of a couple named Sam and Pearl Olliner. And in their book called The Altruistic Personality, he highlights one amazing piece of data that they found, which brought my attention to the book in general. The book is called The Altruistic Personality. And what this couple did is they decided to research, were there any common denominators, any patterns in the backgrounds of the non-Jewish individuals that decided to risk their lives and rescue Jews during the Holocaust versus those that didn't? So if we think of kind of three categories, there were the rescuers, and then there were the non-rescuers, which could break down into bystanders and enablers. So we're not going to look at the difference between the bystanders and the enablers for now, but the difference between rescuers versus non-rescuers. Are there patterns in the backgrounds, in the childhood developmental years of those Gentiles that became rescuers, that had that altruistic personality, that were willing to sacrifice their own lives and their own well-being for the sake of another without any material incentive to do so? And they found that there actually was some consistent findings in what contributed to the type of personality that they came to call the altruistic personality, which is amazing, because if we can identify what those things are, what those ingredients are to developing the altruistic personality, then we can try to mimic that. We can try and proactively copy that. And this is something that I think is so essential in our times. And some of the things that they found in their research speaks to a lot of the different topics or themes that we've already touched on in this series in a way that I think kind of brings it all together and can help us clarify or fine-tune some of the pieces we've spoken about. So I want to talk about five different findings. As best as I can understand from the book, it's a pretty dense book and takes quite a bit of reading and really paying attention to. What I was able to piece together is that there are five things or five ingredients that they were able to identify as having actual consistency, meaning they tried to look at a whole variety of different things. Did religious background make a difference? Did economic status make a difference? Did political orientation make a difference? Did location make a difference of where someone lived? Did the type of town, did the type of occupation of the parents make a difference, etc.? And they found that many of these factors did not have any substantive difference in terms of yielding or developing children that would actually be that would have this altruistic personality versus those that didn't, meaning it went both ways. But they found that there were five different aspects of childhood or of parenting that those who were rescuers described in their childhood years that were substantively different, statistically different from those who were non-rescuers. So we'll go through them one at a time. The first is what they refer to as how much of an emphasis was placed in the home environment on economic competency and independence and self-sufficiency. Meaning to say, how much did parents talk about the importance and the value of economic competency? And what they found is that in the homes of non-rescuers, there was a much higher level of emphasis on economic success, economic competency, independence, and self-sufficiency. In the homes of rescuers, of those that developed altruistic personalities, economic competency, the value of putting an emphasis on financial and material success and independence was much, much lower in those that developed the more altruistic personality. That doesn't mean that in those homes there wasn't a value at all. It doesn't mean it was never spoken about. It doesn't mean it wasn't encouraged or that education or profession wasn't something that was given significance or credence or the capacity to be successful. But it wasn't spoken about. It wasn't something that was, it wasn't spoken about in an overwhelming way. It wasn't part of the routine conversation. It wasn't part of the dinner table. It wasn't part of what people were talking about in a day in, day out kind of routine way. Economic competency was a means towards an end. It wasn't a value unto itself of something that was propped up on a pedestal as this is the goal of life. Versus in the homes of people who developed as non-rescuers, whether that was bystanders or contributors, that in those homes, there was a very significant emphasis placed on the inherent value of economic success. It was seen as something that took center stage as life revolves around this to a much greater degree than in the homes of rescuers. This is a very, very powerful finding. Because what that means is that, according to this research, those who grow up in an environment where financial and material success is emphasized and spoken about in such a dominant way, there is less likelihood of the children growing up in those environments developing the altruistic personality, the caring, giving, fair, kind, generous, and value-driven personality. I think that so often we think of what our values are in theory, but we don't necessarily realize what values we're living, per se. What I mean by that is as follows. There was an exercise I once was part of when I was in something called the Wexner Fellowship, and in the opening kind of cohort activity, group activity, there was a leadership coach there that had each of the 20 of us who were in this fellowship go around and say what our value, what our kind of foremost value is. What is it that we're very passionate about? And everyone said different sorts of things. It was a wide variety of things that people were passionate about in this very wide-ranging group. And then he said, he wrote them all down as we said them. And then he said, if there was an alien watching your life from outer space, would they know based on your life, based on your actions, not based on what you say you value, but based on the way you live, would they know that that is actually your passion, that that's your value? Because if they wouldn't know that, then how real is it in actually being your value? And that was a very powerful kind of mind exercise to think about. I can say what I value, but the only thing I really value is something that the alien watching my life would be able to deduce from my actions, not from what I claim when I'm talking about something. But can an alien deduce that this is my value from observing and watching my life? Later, when I had kids and was, you know, just kind of grew up more in my life, what occurred to me is that what he didn't say in that exercise is that those aliens actually exist. Those aliens are our children. Our children know what we really value. One way to think about this is, what do our children see us get passionate about, get emotional about? What do they notice that? Which things activate us? Does it activate us more when a sports team we care about wins or loses, more than when something of real value takes place in the world, or someone is actually hurt, or there's something sad happening around us? Which one activates us more? When there is a change in a financial situation, does that activate us more or less than when there's a very significant life event that's taking place in our family or community or in the world? There's a line in the Gemara that says, "Ashrei mi shebo lekan v'talmudo biyado." Praiseworthy is the person who comes here, meaning to the next world, and what he's learned is in his hand. And the typical meaning of this is that he has a grasp on what he's learned. He knows what he's learned. He carries it with him. But I've often thought that another way to read it is, praiseworthy is the person that talmudo biyado, that which he's learned is in his hand. It's in his hands, meaning that it can be seen in his hands, that you can see it in the way he lives. Like it says in Pirkei Avos, it says when it quotes different sayings from the Tanoim, from the rabbis in the Mishnah, it says their name and then it says Hu Haya Omer, he used to say. And those words seem somewhat extra, and I thought maybe what it means is that this person maybe never even actually said these words. When it says that one of the Tanaim said that you should see people favorably, you should be patient before judging, whatever it is that he taught. So we always assume he said those words. He said the words, be patient before judging. But maybe he never actually said the words. Rather, it's Hu Haya Omer. He said, meaning his life said this. The way he lived spoke this just by his being, by his actions. The alien watching in would deduce this. He never even had to say it. It was Hu Haya Omer. There's an amazing study that was done by Harvard years ago that they asked a significant amount, I think it was in the thousands, they asked students, school-age children, what do your parents care more about? The grade you get on a test, the grade you come home with that day, or how you treated other people in school that day? And somewhere in the upper 80 or lower 90%, some really, really high number, the overwhelming majority of kids said, my parents care more about my grade. Which is so important to hear, and it's striking, it's kind of jarring. But what's even more interesting is that they then ask the parents of those same kids, they ask them, what do you care more about, how the grade your child gets or how they treat other people? And those very same parents said, again, in the upper 80 or lower 90%, said, we care more about how they treat other people. So there was a huge discrepancy between what the parents actually claim they care more about and what the child experiences the parent is caring more about. And where does that come from? Where does that happen? That happens because of exactly this point. The parent, in theory, of course, most people are good people. Most people, when they're asked point blank, do you care more about a grade or more about how your child treats someone? Of course they care more about how their child treats someone. The overwhelming majority of people are good people, in theory. But then in lived life, what do they show more passion about? What question do most parents ask their kid when they get home from school? They see the grades and they comment on their grades. You know, how did you do on your test today? What did you get on your writing assignment? How did the test go, etc.? How often do parents ask their kids when they get home from school, how did you treat your friends today? Or did you do something kind today for somebody? Or how did you treat the kid that you're actually not friends with, which it's okay to not be friends with, but did you do something nice for someone that you're not friends with? If kids don't ever hear that question, they don't know that their parents value that. And all they hear is questions about grades. So then all they know is that their parents care about grades. And so this incredible divergence or discrepancy evolves in what the child experiences the parent caring more about. So the first thing that they found, that the Ahlers found in this study, was that those children that eventually grew up as adults with more of this altruistic personality, that were willing to be rescuers in the Holocaust, were children who grew up in homes where their parents didn't just preach values, but they embodied those values. That there was a significant difference between the homes in which there was a focus and an emphasis on the inherent value of economic success as almost, in a sense, the be-all and end-all, the goal, the reason for living, the mark of being a successful, well-adjusted adult, versus the homes in which things of more substantive value and meaning in life were what's emphasized. A difference in the homes where the means to an end were the means to an end, and the ends were an end, versus the homes where those things got conflated. There's a great line I once heard from a teacher of mine, Rabbi Mark Gottlieb, who said in the name of C.S. Lewis. He said that C.S. Lewis says, I've never seen this inside, so I'm saying it in both their names, that C.S. Lewis said, when first things are first things, and second things are second things, then you have first things and second things. But when first things are second things, and second things are first things, then you have neither first things nor second things. When you mix up which things are the means and which things are the ends, what is the value of life really about? What is actually meaningful? And what is just a means towards an end? When you mix those things up, things begin to unravel. And well-being and development doesn't take place in the way that we really wish for. That's the first piece that they found. The second thing they found is that there's a difference between homes that preach and that teach about, and also, like we said, embody the value of caring about others versus equity. And I would add also versus entitlement. Meaning to say, entitlement is the kind of communication or the sense that a child receives in a home of entitlement, of I deserve certain things. And that's, again, that's in the air. That's what has meaning. That's the way that we think about things. Versus equity is a little bit better than entitlement. Equity is the concept of things should be fair, that I should give because then I'll get, and I should get because then I'll give, and that everything should be fair for all people at all times. Either one of those two options, even the equity version, does not lead to the altruistic personality. The altruistic personality is a result of a child being in a home where they experience the value of caring. Caring meaning that I'm willing to do something for the meaning inherent in it, for the value of the contribution that my care creates, the impact that it has, as opposed to, well, if I do this, then I get a certain reward. There's a Bala Turim that I really like that says that by Shifra and Pua, when they defied Paro's decree that they had to drown Jewish babies, and they didn't listen. And it says in the Torah, it says, Vayas lahem batim, that he made for them houses. And it's unclear what that means. So there's many different explanations of what it means. And most of the explanations say that, and he made for them houses, is referring to Hashem made for them houses, meaning he made a dynasty for them, or he gave them some great wealth in the future, or in some capacity, some sort of reward. But there's actually a Bala Turim that says that Vayas lahem batim means Paro. Paro made for them houses. It means he put them in jail. And I find that to actually be very powerful, because it's the idea that there doesn't always need to be some, of course, in the end, we hope for a happy ending, but it doesn't always need to be some immediate equity, some immediate reward that comes. Sometimes we do the right thing just because it's the right thing. As the Rambam talks about, Osa emes mipnei shehu emes, a person does the right thing because it's the right thing. And there's a value in caring for others, in the selflessness of others. There's the famous story of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that he received a letter from someone that said, that it was addressed to the Rebbe, that said, I'm really struggling. I'm experiencing so much depression. I'm experiencing so much despair. I feel meaningless in my job. I feel disconnected in my family. I feel uncared for in my community. Going on, I'm experiencing this, I'm experiencing that. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote back the most profound letter without even writing a single word. He took his pen and he circled the word I at the beginning of every sentence and he sent it back to the individual. The message, of course, being that if we're so consumed in our entitlement, and even if we're so consumed in our equity, because equity is really just a better version of entitlement, but it's still a version of entitlement. If we're so consumed in that we don't find happiness, because actually, ultimately, and here's a paradox, when we actually engage in true care, genuine care, and we are more selfless in that way, that actually is what brings happiness. So in a sense, that is the reward, but it's still different because it's an internal reward. And that's not the motivation to do it, but it's an awareness of doing it. As the Rambam says after that line, Osa emes mipnei shehu emes, you do the truth because it's the truth. But then he adds, V'sof hatov lavo. And in the end, good will come from it. There's nothing wrong with hoping and wanting and seeing that there's good that comes from it. But without that being the whole mentality, is what is there in this for me? What's in this for me? What do I get out of this? And instead of the parents in the homes of the non-rescuers who focused on equity or entitlement, the parents in homes of those who became the altruistic personality, the rescuers, were parents who focused on care. I don't know the source for this or the accuracy of this, but I've heard said that the Piasetzner Rebbe, who perished in the Warsaw Ghetto, so he had a group of Hasidim before the Holocaust, and many of them died in the Holocaust, as did he. But they say, again, I don't know statistics on this, but they say, I don't know any hard date on this, that the Piasetzner Rebbe statistically had a disproportionate amount of students who actually survived the war. And they wondered about this, you know, why? How did that happen? And what they found is that they started actually asking some of the students about their experience. And they kept hearing the same story again and again, that as the Nazis were coming in and breaking through the ghetto, and they were all about to be killed or rounded up, or I don't know exactly when it was in time, so I'm not sure I'm saying that accurately, but at some point in this horrible process, the Piasetzner Rebbe ran around to as many students as he could, and he just said to them two words. He grabbed them by the shoulders and he looked in their eyes, and he quickly but sternly and fiercely said to them, "Do chesed." And then he would run to the next student and grab him and look at him and say, "Do chesed." And he imparted this message to as many of his students as he could. And what he was telling them was that even in this place where the last thing you might think about in a concentration camp, you might never think about doing chesed for another person because you're just focused on your own survival, if that's even possible. He was telling them that the best way to survive is actually by doing chesed. When this essential human need to do chesed, to actually be the giver, is taken away because we're so focused on entitlement or equity, we lose that lifeline that we need to be connected to the experience of doing good for others, of connecting to something broader and beyond ourselves. As the Mittler Rebbe of Chabad says, that happiness is the experience of feeling yourself as part of something bigger than yourself. That's what happiness is. Happiness is the experience of being a piece of a bigger whole that transcends the limitations and the constrictions of self. And that comes from a focus in early years and developmental years and throughout life on the value of care as opposed to equity or entitlement. That's the second piece that they found in their research. The third is what they call a difference between an internal locus of control versus a victimhood mentality. that in the homes of those who developed as non-rescuers, the home environment and the parental orientation was one of victimhood. Parents who spoke of themselves and spoke to their children in ways of victimhood versus the homes of those who became rescuers were those whose parents spoke of themselves and towards their children in a way that communicated the concept and the reality of having an internal locus of control, meaning, do I see myself as a victim to situations that I don't have control, I don't have a avenue to impact, to change, to effectuating a difference in what's going on around me? I'm simply a victim. And in that victim mentality, in that victim stance, I'm passive. I'm the subject being acted upon. If I'm being bullied or if I'm experiencing something negative, it's just focused on as the other person is doing something to me versus an internal locus of control where I am able to see where I'm playing a role in this or where I can do something different. Now, this is very tricky because oftentimes we actually are or we can sometimes truly be a victim. But even if we are a victim, which means we didn't do anything wrong or we didn't do anything to deserve it, the key piece here is that that doesn't mean we don't still have an internal locus of control. And that's where people often make the mistake. And this is actually a really important piece of understanding a kind of a dialectic as opposed to a binary. People often think in a kind of binary, meaning it's one way or the other way, that either I validate someone else's feelings or I validate my own feelings and I give space for my pain or someone else's pain and I empathize with it and I see it as being valid and I understand that it's not their fault and what they're feeling is legitimate and the hurt is legitimate, etc. Or I don't do any of that and I say, okay, well, but what did you do? Or, but what can you do differently? What do you need to do? Etc. What do I need to do? How do I need to change? I look at where is it my fault or what did I do? And that's the binary. It's one or the other of those. Versus the dialectic or the duality is that those don't have to actually be mutually exclusive. It's entirely possible that I did nothing wrong, that my hurt and my pain are completely valid and legitimate and deserving of empathy and deserving of space. And yet, there's also something that I can do differently. Or maybe it's not 100%. Maybe there's a lot that was done to me that was not right and that was wrong and deserves empathy. But maybe there is something I can look at and say, okay, but how could I do this differently? Or how could I look at this situation differently? What choices do I have? Can I find a choice even within the experience of something that is hurtful? And there can be empathy and validation. And there can also be an internal locus of control. I was actually just thinking about this because I was reflecting on, I've had the opportunity to work with many couples over the years in the context of therapy. And I've, of course, when that happens, I'm often meeting with couples coming in a lot of distress and in very precarious situations in their relationship. And there have been a few who things were not able to be worked out in the way that was hoped, and the relationship ended in divorce. And I was actually reflecting on the difference between which couples I was able to work with and were able to improve. Relatively speaking, that can mean a lot of different things for a lot of different people, but were able to improve, or were able to at least continually sustain a process of trying and continuing to work on things versus those who we couldn't even really sustain a process of working on things. And as I was thinking about it, it was almost glaringly obvious to me in a moment of what the very striking difference was. Many times couples come in when they're in that situation and have a long story of how their spouse is the one who is at fault, how they're doing so many things wrong, etc. And they don't have any kind of awareness or acknowledgement or expression in any real way. They'll pay lip service to certain things, but not in a way that feels real to what their role in the relational distress is. that's how most couples come in starting. Not always. Sometimes they come in with a little bit more of a shared burden, but oftentimes there's an entrance point of really seeing the other person as the one at fault in a substantive way. But in doing the work, there's a lot of room to work towards both people being able to see where they play a role and where change from their side can be effective and impactful and important. That doesn't mean that they're at fault. It's not really about fault at all. It's just about understanding dynamics and roles and how things play out and how the cycle goes. And so both sides are able over time to start seeing where they have choice, where they have impact that they can make. They're able to reflect on what they're doing and the role they're playing in the relationship. And that doesn't have to, again, it's not a binary. They can still see issues with their spouse and they can still express them. But there's space and there's capacity to see where there's something that they're doing that could use tweaking or change or maybe even fundamental overhaul. When that is able to take place, that's when sustained work is able to happen in the relationship. And at the very least, we can continue working on it. And oftentimes, thank God, we are able to actually improve, either relatively improve or significantly, and sometimes even amazingly improve. And the couples that I've worked with where the improvement or even the sustained work wasn't able to happen is when there was no space for that. There was no space for an internal locus of control. It was only victimhood. It was only the other person is completely at fault. It's all in their camp. And yes, maybe there's this that I do or that I do, but it's not in any significant way. It's not in a way that feels real or feels substantive. And when that's what's going on, there's no sense of, well, I can work on this, and then it just doesn't have any place to go. And I think that there's a very similar importance when it comes to parenting and the experience for a child, where there's often, again, this kind of binary mentality, where some parents will be extremely validating and very empathetic. But what can happen there is that the kid, the child, actually kind of gets lost then in this ocean of their emotions that they don't know what to do with and their sadness. If all they're getting is validation and empathy and a parent making space for the sadness and the pain of what they're coming home with or whatever they're experiencing, but they don't know where to go and they just kind of get swallowed up and lost and they don't have any direction and no one's redirecting them. And that's on the one side of the equation. And on the other side of the equation, you have parents who don't do any of that validation or do very, very little of it. And instead, they just go straight into the problem solving or the solution or even the corrective kind of criticism that they're trying to be helpful. And the parents can be very well intentioned in trying to be helpful, but they're not giving any of that validation. They're going straight into where there is control and where there is problem solving. And both of those can kind of really lead to a misattunement or to a lack of balance or that the missing of that duality that every person needs, which is the duality of I can feel what I'm feeling and that can be legitimate, and there's also choice that I have. And when there's both of those things, and some people need more of the validation and less of the redirection around choice, and some people need more of the redirection around choice and less of the validation, either way, but the important thing is that the recipe really requires both of those ingredients and that we need both of those things. And I think that that is actually a big part of kind of the modern parenting that's a big issue. A lot of the kind of new age parenting focuses so much on the validation piece, but it has forgotten the empowerment of redirection and of creating a sense of control and choice for the child that they so desperately need. And this really leads to a distorted relationship with emotions. And I think it's an overcorrection that's taking place for the previous generation. So it was like, I don't know, I'm making this up, but it was like 20 years ago, it's like, you're not allowed to feel what you're feeling at all. Now it's, whatever you're feeling is exactly what you should do, and your feeling should be, so you're going to feel your feelings, and you're going to feel your feelings as long as you want to, and we'll talk all about your feelings, and just continue talking about your feelings, and we're all going to feel your feelings, and we're just getting lost in this endless storm of your feelings, and where do you go from there? So, for example, if a kid is feeling sad, so it might have been, at some point in time, it might have been, stop being like that. Why are you being like that? Another version would be, oh, you're feeling so sad. Why are you feeling so sad? Oh, that's so sad. I'm so sorry. And just continuing with that. And that's the binary. Versus the duality is that we can acknowledge the sadness, feel the sadness, validate the sadness, and then also say, and what can we do now? Where can we go from here? What do you think we can do to help you stop feeling sad? What do you think we can do to help you start feeling happier, or to do something that's going to create a different feeling for you? What can we do? And that's the significance of the internal locus of control versus victimhood. It's a similar thing with peer interactions. If a kid comes home, let's say, from school, complaining about a friend or about a peer doing something, being difficult or being bossy or whatever it might be, being a show-off. So one version would be to just not really give significance to that. Another version would be to overly signify that. And the duality is to validate that, to listen to the child, give them that space, and then also talk about what do you think you can do differently. And that's not the same thing as blaming the child. There's nothing wrong with that question. It's actually a good question. What do you think you can do differently? That's empowering to the child. That's helpful to them. There's another side to this, is a little bit of a different aspect of the idea of internal locus of control versus victimhood, which is understanding and appreciating the impact of our actions. There's actually an interesting finding that I heard. Again, I don't know hard research on this, but if you look at the lost and found in very affluent community schools versus the lost and found in low-income neighborhoods, you will find that the lost and found in affluent schools is filled with very expensive and significant items, and it's bursting at the seams. The lost and found is bursting. If you look at the lost and found in low-income neighborhoods, it is close to empty. And one theory on this, I'm sure this could be looked at in different ways, but one theory on this is that when a person has so much, they don't really see impact of things. They don't really see the value in things, whether that's in material objects or even just in their actions. Like, if I lose this versus if I take care of this, what difference does it make? And this is kind of connected to something that there's a kind of pseudo-scientific term. It's not a real thing, but they call affluenza. It's very much a real thing. The illness of affluence, but which really kind of essentially erodes our sense of impact, that our choices actually make a difference, that what we do actually matters. There's the amazing story that you might be familiar with about the Yablonner Rebbe, that there was an individual who was a Rebbe in a town, Yablon, before the war, before the Holocaust. And he was an early Zionist and had convinced his very comfortable and thriving community to move to Palestine, to pre-state Israel. And they did so. But they got there. They founded Kfar Hasidim. This story is written up and told over in much more length elsewhere, worth listening to and looking into. Very powerful story. But in short, they got to their place, Kfar Hasidim, that they were going to found, and it was really difficult, very, very horrible circumstance. They didn't have money, and there was a lot of illness, and they were out of food, etc., and out of funds and resources, and he was ashamed, really, really ashamed of what had happened, because he had transplanted his whole community that was thriving back in Europe, and he went to collect funds, but things were getting really, really bad, and suddenly he disappeared, completely disappeared. And apparently he had this Hasidic Rebbe went completely off. and became a real estate, non-religious real estate agent living in California, completely unidentified. No one knew who he was. He was just a kind of person living alone. And he was just in hiding because he was so ashamed and so felt so badly about what he had done to all these people. And years, years, years later, when he was already an elderly individual, somehow someone had tracked him down and brought him back and somehow convinced him to visit this town, Kfar Hasidim, that he had founded all those years ago. And he got there, and when he came, there was a very, very warm and celebratory and really kind of royal greeting for his arrival. And he was really astounded by this because he was all these years living with this sense of shame and guilt. And they thanked him profusely. And what they said to him was, if not for you having brought us to leave Europe and leave the town of Yablon and come to Israel all these years ago, we and all our families would have perished in the Holocaust. And you didn't know why you were doing what you were doing. You may have had other intentions, but you actually saved all of our lives. And from that, he actually began to come back, and I think he lived in Kfar Hasidim, and he didn't become a Rebbe again per se, but he actually started teaching a little bit again and really came back. And it's just an amazing story of appreciating the significance of knowing the impact that our actions have. He was unable to live the life that he maybe could have lived because he had a sense of the impact of his actions in such a negative way, versus when he eventually came to understand the positive impact of his actions. But then another version of this is when someone just doesn't think that their actions have any impact. And that's actually the challenge of what I've seen with clients who actually had, I think I've spoken about this in a previous episode, clients who I've seen grew up in homes where there's only unconditional love, without any sense of conditional love, without any sense of conditional pride, of we're more proud of you when you do this and less when you do this. And we have consequences and boundaries and discipline and rewards and et cetera, when things actually correlate to actions and to behaviors and to accomplishments. When there's only unconditional love and there's only positive regard and there's only overvalidation, so then the child doesn't get the sense that anything they do even has an impact, that nothing even matters. So there's no sense of an internal locus of control. It's almost a glorified version of victimhood. I feel like I'm so good, but I'm almost like, it's in a sense, it's a very counterintuitive form of victimhood because of the fact that there's no sense that what I do makes a difference. I'm just passive. So this is the third characteristic that the Ahlonners found in the homes of rescuers versus non-rescuers, the sense of control and choice versus the sense of victimhood. The fourth and very important piece that they found is discipline. They found that in the homes of those who became rescuers, there was a very healthy amount of discipline. Versus the homes of the non-rescuers, discipline was out of balance. Now, what they found is that it's not that there was necessarily more or less discipline in these different types of homes, but it was the form of discipline, when it came and how it came. In the homes of the non-rescuers, discipline was experienced by the child as being unreasonable, meaning that the discipline didn't have connection to the behaviors of the child. It wasn't about what the child had done. It was about either the parent's own outburst. This, of course, could have been because of the parent's form of discipline having been overwhelming. So no matter what the child's behavior was, there was no proportionality. And that would, of course, take place when there was extreme physical abuse or even extreme verbal abuse. But also, even without it being problematic in terms of physical or verbal abuse, but when the parent's response to something didn't feel that it was related to a behavior, it just seemed to be the parent's own stuff that was happening. Alternatively, It's when the parent's form of discipline felt to not be critical of a behavior, but critical of a being, of an identity. When the child experienced that the parent's response wasn't saying there's something wrong with what you did, but the parent was saying there's something wrong with what you are. There's something wrong with who you are. There's something wrong with you. In any of those forms, the discipline led to a very non-altruistic personality. Similarly, if the discipline was erratic, inconsistent, when it was all over the place, and when there was an inconsistency of which child would be disciplined in what way, in terms of a disproportionality, again, when it was unreasonable, versus all of that, versus when things made sense, which didn't mean, and this is the very important part, it didn't mean less discipline. And actually, what the research showed is even, I'm not saying that I am endorsing or promoting this, but actually, even when physical form of discipline was involved, if the child felt that it was proportionate and related to something they had done, and it wasn't personal, and it wasn't an attack on their identity, but it was related to something they had done, that actually wasn't even damaging to their development. And it actually, in those experiences, was still part of the development of an altruistic personality. But the point being that when maybe there is a discrepancy in which child gets punished or disciplined in a different way, but it made sense because this child needed this and that child needed something else. So when the child experienced that the discipline was actually related to something reasonable, that it actually was about behaviors that were done in problematic ways, then the child was able to correct that behavior and course correct what they were doing. They were able to internalize it and see it positively and experience the parent, as much as they may have been upset at the parent in that moment, but experience the parent as supportive and helpful in a fundamental way, even if they didn't like what was happening. And I think this is also a very important concept for the modern state of parenting, where a lot of people are very afraid and very resistant to really imposing or using consequences and punishment and discipline, when the reality is that it actually plays a very, very significant role. And a lot of people misuse this, either by not using it or by using it in the wrong way, by using it in ways that are very inconsistent, very mood-based, based on the parent, very based on, if I don't want to have to deal with punishing the kid because I'm too lazy, so then I'm not going to do it. But then in another moment, I'm gonna say a punishment that's so outlandish and ridiculous that it's not even real. It's not even something the child can relate to with seriousness. And when the parent has their own unresolved stuff, and that stuff comes out, and the parent and the child experiences that unconsciously as not really being about the behavior they did, but either being about the parent who is now unsafe, or as being about themselves in an identity kind of a way, and not about a behavior that they can correct. That's the fourth. And the fifth ingredient is something that we've spoken about a lot, so I'm only going to mention it here and not go into it in full depth, is the quality of attachment. The homes that children developed the altruistic personality were homes in which there was real, safe, secure, meaningful attachment between the children and the parents. The homes that developed the non-rescuers were homes which had impaired or insecure attachments. The idea being that everything we just listed can only exist in a significant way, in a productive way, in a way that can actually work when it exists in the world of attachment. Rules without relationship equal rebellion. Relationship without rules equal entitlement. And so we need both, and all of it exists within relationship. None of this is possible if there isn't attachment. And so if we think about this for our children and for ourselves, we think about all five of these different things. How do we do these things for our children? And what was our experience of receiving these things? Where do we need to be nurturing others or nurturing ourselves with these types of values and ingredients? And if we're trying to make a change for others or for ourselves, we always need to start small. Think about, if we're thinking about the alien exercise, that we talked about before. It's what kinds of questions do we ask our children? What kinds of questions do we think about at the end of our day before we go to sleep? Do we look again at our bank account, or do we think about how we acted that day, or if we did an act of kindness that day? When we're sending our kids to school, do we say, you know, make sure you take good notes or pay attention, or do we say, you know, make sure you do something kind for someone today? When we compliment and praise ourselves or our children, what are we complimenting and what are we praising? What do they hear us talking about? What do we hear ourselves talking about? What's a Shabbos table filled with? What kind of stories are we talking about? What do we get activated and passionate and animated and emotional about? There's a whole movement that's actually starting, which I think is really important, about actually encouraging the rebirth or the reintroduction of chores, which is really almost a lost art. And children, because of that, don't necessarily feel that impact of their actions, that sense of control. How do we have that duality of validating an emotion and redirecting and empowering with choice? How do we center discipline in a way that it's about behaviors and that it's reasonable and the child can experience it as being connected to that? And how did we experience all of these things in our childhood? And so when we think about our children, if we have children and we are currently active parents, we also need to think about our inner child. And where did the inner child get these things? And which of these things did we get and how? And can we really amplify that and notice all the positive and celebrate that and expand that and feel good about that? And then at the same time, where were there things that may have been missing? And how can we re-nurture that within ourselves? I think that these five different ingredients, these five components that create the altruistic personality and all exist within the fifth, which is the attachment, are really almost in a sense comprehensive summary of the very difficult but doable experience of living in this world. If we're thinking about it as parents, or we're thinking about it as ourselves developing, if we can kind of boil it down into these core components, we have more tangible things to really focus on. Is it that I want to focus on how I'm living my values in an embodied way? Is it that I want to focus on care instead of equity or entitlement? Is it that I want to focus on my control versus my victimhood? Is it that I need to think about how to correct behavior instead of shaming an identity? And or is it the way that I engage in attachment to create vulnerable, meaningful, real attachments in which I experience knowing and being known? And these five things really kind of summarize so many of the different components of the developmental stages that we've talked about, from the moment of birth through the end of the teenage years, and then sending us and launching us off into young adulthood and the stages that come after that, which hopefully we'll have an opportunity in a future series to explore. I hope that you've enjoyed this series and that you've found it meaningful and helpful to you. And I thank you so much for listening.